Chats, the show where I, Josh Pickford, founder of Bear Metrics, hop on a call with other founders and get the stories of how they started and grew their businesses. This week, I talk with Steli Efti, founder of Clothes.io. And in this episode, we talk about growing up as an immigrant kid in a factory town, discovering books at 16, starting a slew of businesses like a DVD rental company and a hypnosis hotline, discovering sales, building a remote team, and a whole lot more. Heads up, there's some swearing in this episode. Now, on with the program. Hey, Steli, thanks for joining me. How's it going?
Good. Thanks for having me, Josh.
Right on. Well, so the way that I kind of like to kick these things off is I'd like to get like your early backstory, sort of Steli as a little kid. So kick it off. I think you were born in Germany. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So I'm originally from Greece. So my family immigrated from Greece to Germany to work in like car factories, like in the car industry as factory workers. And I was born in the south of Germany. It's a very conservative part of Germany. So it's the most German part of Germany. And it's the most culturally opposite part of Europe when you think about Greek culture. So it was a very different place than my heritage. But yeah, born and raised in Germany.
What was, you mentioned were both of your parents working in the auto industry as factory workers?
Yes, both of them, although my dad died when I was super young, so he died when I was six. So okay. For most of kind of my growing up, it was my mom. But both of them originally just worked in a car factory in kind of south of Germany. So the place where I grew up in Germany is where Mercedes has their headquarters, Porsche has their headquarters. So there's basically everybody is either working for these companies or a industrial supplier of these two big companies. Yeah, yeah. So it's like super industrialized part of Germany.
Do you feel like that bled over into? Did you notice as a kid that you were sort of surrounded by this culture or community that's very sort of industrial, like everybody's working in a factory kind of thing?
Yes, but I wouldn't have been able to verbalize it that way. I realized that it was a place that was very much focused on conformity. Like everybody just had like laid out three possible paths to life, and you had to choose pretty early which one you would take. And for some people like me, they would push you in one direction. Like nobody, like with the immigrant kids that I grew up in, the bad neighborhoods that I grew up in, there was never any like you might study and become a doctor. It was always like you're going to finish kind of the lowest level of school you can, and then you're going to get like it's sort of an apprenticeship system where you start working in one of these car industrial factory companies and learn to be an electrical engineer or something, just work at a machine for the rest of your life until you retire. And so I remember that was always kind of the path that was presented to me. And I noticed that because that path was very unattractive to me. And I knew I didn't want that, but I just didn't know what I wanted. So I noticed that. And I noticed that I never quite felt like I fitted in, and I never quite felt comfortable growing up in Germany for many reasons. But it was also funny looking back that most of the people that I knew did very similar job and had very similar lives.
Did you have any siblings?
Yeah, I have two older brothers. So I was the youngest of three.
You mentioned that you even from an early age knew I don't sort of want to conform or, go into any of these paths into, being a factory worker, whatever it is. I mean, what was that like for was it same for your siblings, or did they kind of go down the other path? Or
no, yeah, they were more happy to go down the path laid in front of them and try to be in the kind of, the upper half, the overachieving underachiever immigrants, sort of like sure. they were doing okay in school, not terrible, but not good. And they would get an okay apprenticeship and an okay factory, and they would try to better themselves there and slightly go up in career. So they were much more on a traditional trajectory. And honestly, if I could point to one as the single most important moment in my life in terms of like, you never know, but I think I can identify that moment as a pivotal moment that changed the trajectory of my life was actually a big fight I had with one of my older brothers about success in life. And his whole point in that argument that we had, I was 16 and he was 20 at the time. His whole point of the argument was, if you want to be successful, which to us at that time just meant rich, to be honest. Like, if you want to make a ton of money, you can either become academically successful and become a doctor or a lawyer, or you have to do criminal stuff and sell drugs.
Right.
Right. So it was a very limited viewpoint. He's a harmless, a very great guy today, but he watched a lot of television and was like useless, just like me, and didn't know much. So had watched like Scarface way too many times. It was like, you have to be a gangster or a doctor. Like, just pick or choose. And I hated both of these options. So we were arguing for a while, going back and forth, until at some point he said, hey, smartass, all right, what's your fucking plan? Like, what are you going to do exactly and specifically to make a ton of money in life? And that was the end of the argument. I opened my mouth, but words came out, and I realized, shit, I have no idea. Yeah. What the fuck am I going to do with my life? And I think up until that point, for whatever reason, I had a lot of problems growing up, but one thing I came with from birth, it seems, was kind of like an unexplainable level of confidence. Like I as far back as I can remember as a child, I always thought I am going to do great things in life. I'm going to do big, important things in life. I don't know where that came from. And so I walked around with all that confidence, but no competence or clue, right? I was just, I'm going to be rich and successful one day. And then that argument was the moment I realized how clueless I was, where I was like, wait a second, I'm 16. School is ending in a year or two, and what exactly is my plan? And that led to a chain reaction of events that led me to where I am today. But that argument with my brother was really a big pivotal point.
You mentioned that your dad died when you were really young, and I think for a lot of families, especially when there's, you know, you've got multiple kids, like. A lot of times the dynamic happens where maybe like the oldest kid sort of steps into, especially in this case where you had brothers, like maybe your older brothers sort of move into not like a fatherly role, but at least some sort of like, I got to take care of my younger siblings kind of role. Yeah. So pair this up with you mentioning having like this like huge level of confidence. Like, do you feel like as the youngest kid that you, did you have some sort of like freedom, like you, because you had older brothers who kind of worry about things, like that you had this sort of freedom to be really confident and like to not have to think about like, what am I going to do or how am I going to provide or anything like that?
That's a good question. You packaged a lot. but I do think those are all, a lot of those apply in my situation. So I do think it was nature and nurture to a certain degree. I do think that there is a level, I'm wondering more and more now that I have kids myself, if ambition, how much of ambition is just genetics, right? Versus nurturing it. And so I see it with my two kids that I at least try my hardest to treat fairly equally. And I, with the oldest and my first boys, I made a particular effort to not be ambitious at all with him, right? To not have expectations or try to have him walk or talk or be smart or be capable of anything other than just playing with him, like playing and having fun with him. And just as far as I can remember from the moment he was able to like walk, you could tell this human being is very ambitious, like, and he just can't get it out of his system. And his younger brother, who's equally amazing to me as his dad, doesn't have that ambition. He has all other things, but he doesn't have that. He doesn't bring that to the table. I think I brought that to the table to a certain degree genetically, more so than even my two older brothers. But I do think that I also, probably as the youngest from our family, got a lot of positive reinforcement. Like, I do remember that especially my grandfather, whose name I had, it's a Greek tradition to give the name of the grandfather to the kids or grandparents. And so he was particularly in love with me and proud of my grandfather would tell me oftentimes in many terms that I was awesome and amazing. Right. So I think I probably got a lot of love because I was the youngest in the family. And then I already had that kind of internal drive from the get-go. I also think that, you know, I think when my dad died, it fucked us up in all of us in many ways, different ways, right? All of us kind of were impacted in different ways by it. But I do think because I was the youngest, I do wonder oftentimes if I got away from it kind of with the least amount of harm. I definitely know that my oldest brother, he was like, in a place where he took on way too much responsibility and developed this, like, I'm now the father, I have to be now the super dominant authoritarian at home and protect my mom from things. I do think that it had a negative and stressful impact on him, more so than on me as the youngest. So I do think it had, I was a bit shielded from some of those things because of the fact that I was just, you know, the youngest kid in the household.
Yeah. You mentioned, this argument with your brother, and at that point you were kind of close to the end of school. Like, what was school like for you? Did you like it? You hate it? Like,
oh, man.
What was that experience like?
I hated it with a passion. I, you know, again, in hindsight, lucky or unlucky, I got into school, I think, 2 months after my dad died. So it's just like, that was not good timing in general. And then I got really unlucky or lucky when it comes to my first grade school teacher. She was an exceptionally bad human being, at least to me. And so the problem was that back when I grew up in Germany, today things have gotten a lot better, a lot more mixed. But back in the time when I grew up, I went to a school that was fairly German. That meant like high percentage of like German kids versus immigrant kids. And the school, the classroom was pretty divided. Like the immigrant kids were all in the back row on the right. And then the German kids were kind of left into the middle. And all the girls is always like at the front, kind of the best grades. And so I remember that this particular teacher was very aggressive towards the immigrant kids and towards me and a friend of mine that was also a Greek kid. And when she heard us speak Greek to each other in the break, she like lost her fucking mind and slapped me and just like overly aggressive. And I think a few years later, I read that she was kicked out of school because of her behavior. But I just remember that from first class, school felt like terror to me. Like, it just felt like I'm going to a place where I'm not welcomed, where I'm treated badly. And I have this teacher that is just so aggressive towards me. And I remember a lot of people, I think, because of the way that I'm perceived oftentimes today, I would assume of myself that I was like a loudmouth kind of annoying kid. And I was actually really, I think very quickly in school, I realized I have no chance here. I can't, I have zero power and this isn't for me. So what I'm going to try to do is find a place, hide somewhere in the classroom and just try to get this over with, but not without creating any additional friction. And so even with that strategy, it really wasn't going well. So the first few years in school were really bad. And I think that just led to me having a troubled relationship. So I hated school. I hated learning. I thought I hated reading. I didn't read a book till I was like 16 and had that argument with my brother. And so I was just barely scraping by, but I really, really hated the entire experience of going to school.
Well, you know, you mentioned your teacher and how she was really aggressive. I mean, how, so stepping back a little bit, sort of a larger question around that, like how do you feel like you generally react to people who are that way towards you? I mean, like, does it make you want to either be aggressive back or just like want to work harder? Or is it like, you know what, I'm gonna pass on you, you know?
Yeah. Like, yeah, I think that's a great question. And I've talked about this and thought about this many, many times. I do think that I think this was more luck than anything else. This was definitely not taught to me by my mother or my brothers or anybody else. I think that my natural reaction, when an authority figure is telling you you're not going to amount to anything, there are really just two reactions. Either you believe it or you rebel against it, right? And so I was lucky that I didn't believe that. Like, my internal natural response was to rebel against it. But my rebelling against it was not public or outwardly, right? So I knew if I started screaming at this lady or started acting up, I would just cause more pain on my life. Like, I just instinctively knew this is not going to work in my favor if I start creating more issues with her. So what I did, I just quietly was brewing a little soup that was basically like, I'm going to fucking show you. Like, I'm going to show all of you people, you're going to eat your shit. All your opinions about me are wrong, and I'm going to prove all of you wrong. Like, so it created this chip on my shoulder that kept growing throughout school. But it was a very quiet internal thing. I didn't tell that to anybody. I didn't speak up because I very quickly calculated that this just is not going to go well for me if I try to like act this out and win in this classroom right now. There's just no chance for me. So that was my reaction to this, was just to start and fuel my internal fire and my internal ambition even more and go, I'm going to prove the world wrong. and I'm going to prove these people wrong.
So what, I mean, how did that translate through to the rest of school? Like, obviously you mentioned this teacher early on, but I mean, what about later on in school? Like, did that stick with you the whole time?
Almost the whole time. Yeah. So, up until I was 16, I had a bunch of teachers that were, a bunch were harmless. The ones that were good, I didn't really benefit from because I was so disengaged, right? And they didn't really engage with me. They didn't really care. But the bad one, but I did have some bad luck, like a few more teachers that were not quite as bad as her, but still not that great. And so overall, that was my entire experience throughout school, was just like, I don't like these people. I'm not interested in this thing. So how can I just like, how can I get just through this? Right. And then when I was 16, I had this big argument with my brother that led to a number of events. One of those events was me realizing that I actually didn't hate reading. Like, I was that around that time that I started reading, that I read my first book and then a second book. And then I realized I actually love reading. I just never have been gotten a book that I was interested, that I wanted to read. Right. And so I'm actually, and then I realized I actually like learning. I like learning things, because up until that point, I confused school with learning. Right. And I thought I don't like to learn things, but then I realized, no, I do like to learn things. I just didn't like to learn what they wanted to teach me and how they wanted to teach it to me. And so, and then around that time, it was also the time where, you know, in the German school system, you have to make a decision. Your grades have to be to a certain degree where you go into one of three kind of higher school systems. So either you go on the path to be able to go and study at university, or you go on this other path. It's like you're going to get some kind of a good apprenticeship or a good like job, practitioner job. And then there's the lowest path, which is for people that, you know, are doing really, really, really poorly in school. And that really doesn't lead to anything productive. And so there's one year in German school where the grades define to which school you're going to go afterwards. And up until that point, my grades were terrible, just horrible. And that me realizing I wanted to become successful and I had to figure out how, me starting to read some books and figuring out that I want to read, came all together with that year. And then I realized I don't want to have such bad grades that I'm going to be forced to go and work at a factory, right? So I have to hit a certain grade mark. And that meant that for the first time in my life, I started studying for school. And my grades went from almost the worst person in the class within that year to graduating as the best kid in class.
That's really interesting that, I mean, the, you know, it's like you still didn't necessarily love the school, but you now had, you had a goal to work towards.
Yes. I was right. And it was a negative goal, which is very motivating, unfortunately. Right. So the panic and fear of ending up in a factory was a much stronger driver than the potential, like you're going to get a good job in life, right? I was more short-term motivated by, I cannot go through this year and then have to go to a factory. I need to hit a certain level of notes. Great. But then what happened is the first two or three tests that I studied for, I got a straight A, and I didn't expect that. And when I got the A, I was like, huh. And that just readjusted my internal goal to now wanting to have A's in every test, which is something I almost accomplished. I graduated with a degree that's like a 1.0 would be a perfect A score, and mine was like a 1.6 or something. So pretty good. But the motivation was really just short term. It was not failing this year and then having to go work for a factory. And then when I passed with like a fucking, like I got a certificate and I got like one of the best kids in the school grade. And it was very surprising to lots and lots of people, me included to a certain degree. The right. very next year when I went to this like higher level school, I went back to terrible grades. I went straight back to like terrible, terrible grades because, you know, crisis was avoided and I had no motivation now to instantly be good again.
Well, what's like, so, okay. So you end up on this career path. That's like you accomplished the sort of intermediary goal of not ending up in a factory. But I mean, yeah, what was the next, was there no goal at all after that or?
No, that was around the time where I started developing my goal and vision for myself, which was that, you know, that argument with my brother led me to go to a bookstore and buy the first book that I've ever bought. The book that I bought was a book that was titled "Everything You Need to Know About Stocks," The reason I wanted to buy a book about stocks is because I was, you know, left with that question, how am I going to get rich? How am I going to get rich? And I remember watching a movie about people getting rich, which was Wall Street. It's very cliche, but it's the truth. And I was like, these people made a ton of money and they were doing something with stocks. And I had no idea, what is it? What are stocks? I don't know. What is this? Is this a certain collection of rocks? Is this has to do with cows? Like, I didn't have no concept of anything that has to do with the financial world or entrepreneurship or anything like that. So I was like, I should probably know what stocks are. Maybe that's a good way to get rich. And then I was like, well, where do people go to learn things? Books. Shit, I might have to buy a book and try to read. And then I got lucky that I bought the cheapest book on the subject because I didn't have a lot of money. This is all a huge chain of like lucky events, because the book that I picked up for $4.99 was written for somebody who's $4.99 for a book. Like, it was big picture, simple words, simple, and I could comprehend it. If I had just picked a slightly more sophisticated book, I don't know where I would be today, right? It might have like put me on a different path. So I read that book about stocks and I had this amazing moment of like realizing, learning something, right? And I was like, oh my God, this is what stocks are? This is what business is? And you can have ownership over, like, it was like the most amazing realization of my life up until that point. And I was like, oh my God, I have to go back and I need to know more. And that led to me buying more and more books. And eventually, you know, buy a bunch of books about stocks, you stumble over entrepreneurship and business. And then I realized, wait a second, anyone can start a business? I don't need a certificate. I don't need a PhD or a doctorate. Like, I don't need to get anybody to give me approval to start a business. I can start a business today. And if I work really hard and if I'm really creative, I can make that business potentially massively successful. Nobody needs to approve of me, my name, my looks, my background, my school grades. That's it. That's what I'm going to do. So, you know, between 16 and 17, I made the decision I'm going to be an entrepreneur.
Well, right. I mean, well, what was it about stocks? I mean, to me, this is a personality kind of thing, I think, really, but like, right. I imagine myself as a 16-year-old reading a book about stocks and then promptly like gouging my eyes out. Like, what was it that made you say, hey, this first book that I've ever, you know, really sat down and read was so interesting, I'm going to keep reading about it. Like, what about the book?
So the things that the book described that were really, to me, exciting, it explained that these businesses are entities that people can have ownership in. It's something I didn't know, didn't realize.
Like, that whole concept was just like completely foreign to you, and then all of a sudden...
Completely foreign to me. It's like, it was like, you know, it's hard to explain, but the related thing, to give you an example... Like, me realizing I could own a part of Coca-Cola was like, holy shit. Why is that? Yeah. Why doesn't everybody needs to know this? Like, there was a time where it just like annoyed the hell out of everybody because I was like, all you people, you need to know this information. Like,
you can own it.
Yeah, you could be an owner in McDonald's and Coca-Cola. Are you shitting me? Like, why are we all doing this? Like, why are we all owning these parts of these companies that we're consuming and that are growing in value, and so that our money grows in value and we could get rich? Like, why is this not something everybody does, right? And I remember one distinct scene where I was in this tiny kitchen with my mom cooking a meal, and for like I think an hour talking into her about this, and my mom, you know, she's amazingly patient. So she was just like listening and smiling and encouraging me, but like having no fucking idea what I'm talking about and what I want from her. And so that, I think that concept of like, I could own part of a business. And then that led to the, businesses are nothing else than, you know, somebody, you know, starts it. Everybody can start a business, and business can grow fast or slow. And if you have ownership in a business that grows fast, that creates wealth. I was like, oh, all these things were really, really mind-blowing to me. And they led to, I think, you know, as I started buying a bunch more books about stocks, eventually my curiosity led me to, you know, it was always the corner of the business book. So at some point I just saw a book about some entrepreneur on there that I recognized from some, like, I don't know, McDonald's, Coca-Cola, IBM, something, some logo I realized and recognized, and it was saying the founder and CEO of this company. I was like, huh, maybe I should buy this book and learn how this person did this. And that kind of led me down the path of like learning and realizing that, oh, entrepreneurship could be the option that is right for me.
So, okay, so you figured this out when you're, what, 17-ish?
Yeah, 16, 17, yeah.
So, I mean, what did you do with that sort of realization in regards to school?
Yeah, so that then again, that answered the question, do I really need to care about school? Because like, no, now I know what I need to do. And I don't have to go to a factory if I don't go and graduate from college. So I think, you know, it was right that year where I lost kind of my motivation to continue school. And I started thinking more and more, how can I, well, I know now a little bit about this entrepreneurship thing, but how do I do this? How do I start? And again, I got a little lucky because just before I was 18, so my mom had very little money, and she raised the three of us on her own. She's an amazing woman. She went through a lot of hard things without ever complaining a day in her life about any of it. And one really cool thing that my mom did is she recognized, I think early on, that she wouldn't have a lot of money to give us. But she was like, when they're 18, they're going to need to get a driver's license, which in Germany back then was expensive. You had to pay like $2,000-$3,000 to get a driver's license. You had to go to a certified teacher driving school, and you'd have to take courses for weeks and pay them a lot of money. So it's not as accessible as the system is in the U.S. And so she knew they're going to have to pay a few K to get a driver's license, and then, you know, $1,000-$2,000 to get a first cheap car. They're going to need this. I want to provide for them for this. So she set up some kind of a savings plan that allowed for us when we were 18 to get, I don't know, a few K from her to be able to pay for these expenses. And so right around the time that I get more and more passionate about stocks and entrepreneurship, and I get bored at school and think I want to do something, right around the time is the time where I'm just about to turn 18. And so this fund, this money is now available to me. And I made the quick decision, you know what? Fuck a car and fuck a driver's license. You know, I'm just going to take the bus and the train, and let me take that money and start buying some stocks. And again, in hindsight, you know, hindsight 2020, I got very lucky again. You know, there's a lot of luck involved in my early years. And so the things that I bought, I thought I had like some kind of a magic math and rationale and strategy behind it. But obviously in hindsight, it was totally clueless. And so I was buying these stocks, and I was being lucky with my timing in the market. And so these stocks were going up, which was reinforcing my belief that I'm brilliant, right? And that this is what I should be doing. So I you know, increased that little bit of money to something sizable quite quickly. And then I got so overconfident that I was like, you know what? I should be teaching kind of immigrant families, these factory worker families that have some money on the side, how to like invest in stocks and how to manage their money better. And maybe I can do this professionally. That can be my path forward. So I started doing that a little bit on the side, and then very quickly realized I'm actually quite good at getting people to trust me and having people want to work with me and give me their money, and I can make a living with this. So I just dropped out of school right around between 18 and 19, I think. And I just started doing that. And again, to summarize that phase of my life, is like a 2-year time where I was doing financial services, basically, or running a small financial services company. I'd hired a bunch of people later and trained them and yada, yada, yada. But I got really, really lucky. My timing of getting into that space, and when I realized this is a bad space and I probably should get out of it, and I don't want to harm people, I don't want to sell them financial products that are bad, and I don't like this industry, I got really lucky that I learned a bunch of really crucial lessons about money and riches and all that. And I got out at a great time. So in hindsight, all the clients, all the people that I was recommending things and everything that I did was very, very successful, but not because of skill. It was just because of luck and timing.
Gotcha. Okay. So you've done all this financial stuff. I mean, at this point, have you kind of, I don't know about burned out on stocks, but like realized you have interests outside of financial services?
Yeah, very quickly. I got, again, lucky that I met a guy that was in the same industry. I was going to all these events and tried to learn as much as possible and network. And I met this guy that was a multimillionaire, very high up executive at one of the largest financial services company at the time. And he took a liking at me. And so he took me under his wing. And at first, he taught me a lot about sales. He taught me a lot about the financial markets. He taught me a lot about entrepreneurship. So I learned a ton from him. It was an amazing time. And then I started looking behind the curtain and learning things from him that he didn't want to teach me. Like, wow, this guy makes $4 million a year. And every other month at midnight, he's in this office, you know, in a panic, trying to sell stock and other stuff because he's overinvested. Like he has too many employees. He has too much real estate, too many stocks, too much stuff. So he has zero liquidity. And whenever he has a bad month in his business, he's in a panic. It's like, this sucks. This is not how I imagined rich people living life. And then I realized his marriage is terrible. And then I realized he has all these employee issues and he's all these like internal issues. And I met a bunch of other rich people through him that were even worse human beings. Like he was actually a good guy, but he had like a lot of problems. But there were a bunch of people that were terrible human beings. And I think it was during that time that I got an education in, okay, I really don't like these people. And I don't want to become these people. Like I thought I wanted to. I thought I wanted to have a Ferrari and make $3 million a year and be wearing a great suit and seem successful. But now I realize I don't want to be a douchebag and I don't want to be deeply depressed, unhappy, and fake in some ways, right? So this is not really what I thought it would be. And this is definitely not what I want from life. And another thing happened is when I started building a team and hiring people, I started realizing that when I was making, like when I got the biggest check I ever got, which was, you know, I'm 19 and I got like a 30K check. Yeah. For a month's worth of work, right? And which was the exact same amount my mom was making a year working at a factory. I realized that that was not making me feel that happy. But when an employee of mine, you know, closed a big deal, or when they called me and they had some kind of breakthrough, or when I coached them through something, that gave me the massive like level of fulfillment and happiness. And those realizations made me go, okay, I love entrepreneurship. I love people more than money necessarily. And I don't want to be in an industry where I just like, it's just about greed and robbing people and I'm not really creating value. I knew these things. And then I started during that entire time, again, it was an overlapping timeline where I started reading more and more books about psychology and communication. And eventually I stumbled over hypnosis and I started studying that. And then I started going to workshops and seminars. At first, my goal was really just become more effective communicator. But eventually I just met some amazing human beings that were, executive coaches, communication coaches, sales coaches, hypnosis trainers. And I got really deep in that world and I realized this is a much cooler world. I really love what I'm learning. I love the things that the value that this is creating. And maybe that's what I should do. And I had a bunch of people that I liked that I'd met throughout these events. And we formed a hypnosis workshop company and a neurolinguistic programming workshop company. And I went out of the financial industry into that. And at the same time, maybe much more relevant to the listeners of this podcast, one of my clients that I was doing financial advising to had brought this concept of these 24-hour DVD rental machines to Germany. You probably know Redbox.
Yep.
Have you ever heard of Redbox?
Yeah, yeah.
So these machines, these DVD rental machines, they were invented in Italy, of all places. There were two companies there that had the worldwide patents on them. I had met the guy that had brought, that had the German wide rights to bring these machines to Germany. And Germany was a particularly good market for that back in the day because video stores had to close on Sundays because of the church law there or whatever. Yep. I started a 24-hour DVD rental chain business during the same time that I started the hypnosis and all that other stuff. And that chain did really, really well. And that plus the kind of coaching company that got me out of the financial services industry.
So, okay. So all sorts of interesting stuff to jump on here. Okay. let's jump on the DVD rental thing. So, or at least to start here. So that's, you know, you think of like today there's so much, the barrier to entry to starting a business is incredibly low, especially in the software space. Now, back in, what was this, like early 2000s? Probably.
Oh shit! I came to the US in 2007. This is probably 2004 or five.
Okay. Something like that. So early, 2004. I mean, not only is software not as accessible as it is now, but I mean, hardware is even higher barrier to entry. Like, how did you end up doing DVD rental machines?
Yeah, I didn't. I would have never been able to build the machine or come up with it. Right. So. The concept was pretty simple because we would just purchase the machine, right? And the machine would come ready with a flat screen. It was, you know, it wasn't a touch screen, but it was like a screen and people could push a bunch of buttons to screen through all the available DVDs. The actual machine was fairly simple. Like, it was, mechanically speaking, it was a very dumb thing. It didn't do anything like any rocket science. I think the hardest thing that we had to solve for in Germany was that we, together with a bunch of other people that wanted to purchase these machines and the company in Italy, we had to figure out some kind of a system to, and eventually it ended up being a fingerprint reading system for these machines. Because the way that video rental worked in Germany was that there were not separate video rental stores for PG-18 movies and under, right? It was like you would go to the same store and the store would just have a separate section for these horror movies or porn or anything else like that. Yep. Now, in a DVD machine, how do you do this? How do you prevent somebody giving a younger kid a card to get into? It was always, these machines always had to be in store. So we had these tiny little stores. Imagine like a bank when you go inside to ATM machine. Yep. Be a tiny little thing and the machine would be kind of in a wall there. But somebody could still conceivably give this to an underage kid to go and, you know, rent whatever movie they wanted. So we had to have some kind of a prevention mechanism, and that ended up being a fingerprinting reader. So when you wanted to create a club membership, you get the card, we would scan your fingerprint, so only you could use your card to rent a movie or bring a movie back. That was kind of the hardest thing. But technologically, I really didn't have a lot to do there, right? I really didn't. The whole thing was just more about, I think what I learned in that business more than anything else was branding, pricing, and then location. Like as a retail thing, right, location was really the most crucial thing. And I didn't really realize that. And along the way, we really learned how important it was. And we would spend an insane amount of time just trying to find a location. It was like, would take 3 months of like every day driving around, visiting, looking through, you know, whatever advertisements were, calling brokers, just driving aimlessly and stopping at places that seem to not be doing well or being closed and trying to figure out who owns this and how can I get in touch. Like, it was a lot of that. And I didn't realize how crucial the location would be, but we found a location fairly on that was so great that store was making, I think, five times the amount of an average store in Europe, like the Europe numbers, because lots of countries started to have these machines everywhere. We had this one location that was just crushing it. I think that was highest revenue generating location in Europe for all these machines. And that really was the aha moment of like, wow, we need to invest a ton of time on location. But technology-wise, I didn't have to really build the hardware or the software for any of this.
Well, so, I mean, where did you get the capital just to like buy the machines and do the...
Yeah, it was not that expensive, honestly. So I think all in, it took us about 30,000 or so to open the first store. And here's a funny story coming back to my brothers. At that time, I'd already had like, I don't know, 2 years or so of like quote unquote entrepreneurial experience. And I had had some financial success, right?
Right.
And so the story in our family formed of like, well, Stelly is the crazy kid that does these risky things. That's not for us. My two brothers were like constantly telling me, this shit that you do is just not for us. Too risky. We don't want risk. And I, in my mind, I was like so sold on entrepreneurship that I was like, these guys just don't know what they're talking about, right? So they're just so indoctrinated, they don't realize that maybe entrepreneurship would be great for them. So I just need to find a hook. I need to find a way to get them in this. So when I had this client and he told me about this video store, I pitched this to my brothers. And I started that business with my brothers.
The DVD?
Yeah. And my pitch to my brothers was as follows. This is going to take 30K. I'm going to provide most of it. So all I need from the two of you is like, 2 to 5K each, which they had in savings. And this store, if it does the average numbers, it would generate an extra 300 to 500 euros a month for each of you, which is going to be a good chunk of a monthly payment if you buy an apartment, which was both of their goals in the next few years. I'm like, this could pay a good chunk of your monthly mortgage, right? It's a fun thing. We'll do it together. Very little risk. If we lose the money, whatever, it's just 2-3K. And they got excited about that. They're like, oh, that's a cool idea. That's like, we could start this and it doesn't take a lot of overhead or management and it would generate a few hundred euros. That would be amazing. And then that first location, instead of making, I think we had forecasted it to generate, I don't know, 4-5K in revenue. For the first month, it was generating 12K in revenue.
Ew.
And I think very quickly, within 3 or 4, and then within 2 or 3 months, I then upped my pitch and was like, guys, this is going so well. Instead of taking out money, why don't we take all the money and reinvest it in just opening more locations? And they, you know, greed and everything. So they got, oh, yeah, why not? And so within, I think, a year, both of them, because all these locations were going really well for us, I think very quickly they realized, it is this easy to be making tens of thousands a month? Holy shit, we're the best entrepreneurs in the world. Fuck working for a factory. Like, they both totally sold themselves that entrepreneurship is easy and that's what they want to do with their life. And they got really excited about that. And then just to give a little conclusion to the story, which I think might be important to people to hear. Before I, you know, we'll get to this, or we might get to this, but at some point I sold everything I had. I was supposed to sell my shares in that DVD rental company to my brothers, and I ended up gifting it to them. And I sold my other assets, and I bought a one-way ticket and came to Silicon Valley to start a first tech company. When that happened, they were like, all right, we got it from here. We have all these locations. We have this businesses up and running. We're good to go. And that was around the time that, you know, Netflix and all these other online streaming services started popping up. Oh. So that industry took a massive tank, right?
Yeah.
And my brothers tried four other businesses after that. All failed, all of them. And my brothers at some point were in such a financial tough situation. Both of them had families, children, that they were working basically three different companies. They had like there's a whole other story, but they had like a coffee shop that like a skin removal franchise, a bunch of DVD rentals. And besides all that, they had to wake up every morning at 3 a.m., go to UPS, and for 4 hours, pack UPS trucks.
Wow.
Before then, they would go to work because they couldn't pay rent. They couldn't buy food. They were financially in massive trouble. It was during that time that I greatly regretted me convincing them to get into entrepreneurship. And I felt really, really terrible about it. They went through some hard times. Now they've come out of it a better man. And today they are still in business for themselves. Have a small business that is doing really well. And they're financially in a really good situation. But it's still, the story is still, even today, like Stelly is the crazy, super ambitious guy. And we're now just happy that we have a good, solid, small business that is giving us a great income and providing greatly for our families. And that's all we need, right? We don't need more. But that's all the whole story on the DVD rental thing, how much it cost, how much it made, and the impact of it to our family.
I mean, you think of like the type of, if you try to think of any other type of business, like one where, you know, that whole industry just completely got upended over the course of like, you know, I don't know, 36 months or something. Like,
yeah,
that's tough.
Our timing getting in was great.
Sure.
And then my timing of going out was brilliant. If I'd actually gotten money, I didn't make a penny. Like, so I sure. basically lost the whatever 10K that I put in there because we always reinvested. And then I gifted my share of the business to my brothers.
Yeah.
But yeah, when I left, they started going down. And at first I was like, my God, my brothers can't even maintain the room in there. They're these losers. But then we all realized, oh, this is what happens when an industry goes extinct and you're in it. Yeah, it's not fun.
Oh, man. Okay. So during the DVD rental stuff, you're also getting interested in hypnosis. Is that correct?
Yes,
okay.
That's correct.
So, I mean, what became of that sort of interest of yours?
Yeah, so I stumbled into that, right? So I don't think anybody ever is like, I shouldn't say nobody, but I didn't want to learn hypnosis. I was not drawn to it at all, but I was drawn to self-help. So I read a bunch of self-help books, then I was drawn to psychology. I read a bunch of books about psychology and, you know, Freud and all these guys. And then I got drawn into NLP, neuro-linguistic programming. And I started learning more and more about that and got fascinated. Just the idea of like, learning to understand my mind better, my psychology better, but also learning to be better and more effective communicator. That was very appealing to me. And then eventually I booked a course that was like a number of workshops. And one of them, most of them were covering topics that I was interested in. Just one of them was about hypnosis that I was absolutely not interested in, but I was like, whatever. It's just one, it's just a 2-day thing and I'll just suffer through it all. Just not go. And then it turned out to be the most amazing thing of the whole course, right? And I realized, oh shit, I didn't know what hypnosis was, and I didn't realize all these things about language and how language works and the subconscious works. And I got really, really passionate and excited about it. So I studied more and more and learned more and more and did more workshops, did more work. I met two people through going through all these workshops there that were also kind of young, ambitious, interested in the topic. And I pitched the idea at some point to them for the three of us to start a company in this space. And again, because I had a bit of a background in the financial services industry, and I knew a lot of people in that industry, I was like, maybe we could just teach people in sales hypnosis or neurolinguistic programming or like communication techniques. They're always interested. They have money, and maybe that's a cool business. So we did a bunch of stuff. I'll summarize it to you as in, we spent a lot of time daydreaming. We designed two different corporate entities with logos and all kinds of other bullshit. I created a hypnosis hotline, the first German hypnosis hotline that ever existed, with an official phone number, which was incredibly hard to get back then, and all sorts of like recorded. The idea was like every day you could call this number and you would get like a 2-minute hypnosis session to refresh in the middle of your professional day. And I would record that. And I wrote the song for that, the music for that. I recorded the trance for that and all. We did all this activity, but the only thing we didn't do, my friend, is get any customers or actually make this a real business, right? So there was a lot of like work put in business plans and models and websites and logos and all kinds of shenanigans, but really that thing never turned into a real growing or even functioning business. Because during the time that we did all this, I started, it was right around the time that Web 2.0 was happening.
Yep.
And so a lot of news about Wikipedia, YouTube, user-generated content. So I started reading more and more of that stuff. Up until that point, I had very little to do with technology. I spent maybe 5 minutes a month online, like very, very little. But I started seeing this more and more, YouTube, Wikipedia, and I started visiting these sites and reading more about it. And it was right around that time that I got an idea for a tech company or an internet startup. And that really led me away from continuing to pursue to build this hypnosis company and led me to wanting to come to the US and build this big startup that I thought would change the world.
So the hypnosis company is... it's interesting to me from the perspective of, how do you decide to like your thing that you've got an interest in? And I feel like I suffer from this where I find a thing that I like doing or that I'm interested in, and then I try to figure out a way to like monetize it or turn it into a business.
Yeah.
Was that the case here? Was just like, well, I like business. I like hypnosis. Let's combine them.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it was a very natural instinct, right? So I hear you on that, right? You get really passionate about something and instantly, I even had this about a totally different topic the other day, right? I was talking to a friend about psychedelics, right? Mm-hmm. And all the research that is happening there to treat, people with PTSD and other real big mental health issues with psychedelics and the massive impacts and the great results that the scientific world is seeing there. And instantly, as we're having this discussion, like 10 minutes later, we're thinking about this big business that could be built around. So it's just like naturally where my mind will go. And I think back then it's the same thing. It's like I get passionate about something. Why? Because I see value in it and I receive value from it. And it was something that was a blind spot for me or something I wasn't realizing before. And then I get this urge to share this with the world,
sure.
Right? I think that comes from a very honest place. And then I think it's not necessarily the how can I make money with it? It's just naturally the way that I know how to organize my life, bring things to the world is like the vehicle of business. So instantly it's like, well, if we turn this into this and we included these people and we turn it into that, it could be an entity, an organization that brings more of this to the world. And then it could be big and it could be valuable.
It's like a method of distribution, basically.
Yeah. So I think it was just the instinct that led me there. I didn't think through is hypnosis business a good business?
Right.
What are the profit margins? Can this be good or big or scale? I didn't think about anything.
Sure.
Just naturally gravitated towards trying to turn this into a business. And I think I quickly realized that with hypnosis, my interest was much more, at that time at least, much more about learning, exploring, sharing. And I was really unmotivated about doing hardcore sales and trying to close clients and contracts and get people to some kind, like I wasn't really interested in the business side of things, which is ultimately what led this thing to never become a real business.
Right.
But also I think learned that you can waste a lot of time with bullshit, right? With logos and names and websites and all kinds of things that really don't matter at the end. And not that I fully learned that lesson, because I repeated that same mistake when I came to the US and started my first tech company in many ways, but it was a lesson nonetheless.
So, okay. So you mentioned the tech company. So you, I think earlier you said something that you sold everything and just sort of packed it up and came to the US. I mean, tell me about that. What was that like?
Yeah, that was the great and amazing adventure that, you know, didn't quite turn out the way that I thought it would. So I had this idea, and I thought that, and this idea was basically, this is 2006, 2007, and the idea was to create an open school. So a place online where anybody could teach and study from anyone else around the world, right? An open, everybody could create these virtual classrooms. Everything that was taught there was recorded and captured. So it was a user-generated school, if you want to. I was thinking Wikipedia is a library and YouTube is the television. We need a new paradigm for school, right? And I even, you know, today I see this with Lambda School and a bunch of other things that are going on. But even back then, my thinking was, well, credentials are bullshit. Like showing me grades to know if you have skill in something is bullshit. There's all these people that have incredible talent, but maybe no easy way for the world to know that and tap into that. So what if a way that people would get credentials, maybe similar to the way that that some other sites did it, is that the more you taught and the more feedback you got from people that what you're teaching is correct and valuable, the more credentialed you get around this topic. And eventually the business model would be that companies could find a massively talented people by kind of how much they've taught about something, right? And so that was the idea. And I thought that idea was so big. I thought it was the reason I existed. I think it would be the legacy of my life. I hated school so much, so now I would personally change the global school system, right? Small goals, small goals. And so I was so overwhelmed by this idea and vision that I was like, all right, fuck everything. I'll sell everything I have. And I go to Silicon Valley, because I didn't know anything about technology or software or the internet, really. I didn't know anybody else who knew anything about it. I went to a school in the town that I was from that had a computer science program. And I, at the breaks, I would like basically bother every computer science student there. And I quickly realized, holy fucking shit, all these kids know nothing about Web 2.0. They know nothing about startups. They're not interested at all about like coding a cool product with me or anything like that. Like, They are learning computer science, but with an eye on like getting a job again in a big kind of industrial company or IBM or a consulting job or something like that. So I'm like, I've been reading about startups and the web for 3 months, and I already know more than all of these people. This is not the place for me to be.
Right.
I need to go somewhere where I'm the dumbest person in the room. So that led me to sell everything I had, buy one more ticket, and come to Silicon Valley. And in my, you know, again, ignorance and arrogance, and in my wishful thinkingness, I really thought this would go like this, Josh. I would arrive in Silicon Valley. To a certain degree, I wanted to be underprepared, because that makes the hero story more appealing. Sure. So I was like, I'm going to arrive there. I don't know anybody or anything. I don't have a visa. My English was not quite that good. And I will just, you know, make my Hollywood movie out of this and meet the people and work hard and fall and almost fail, but in the last second, turn around and then make this a huge success. And my goal, my thinking was really, within a few years, I'm going to build a billion-dollar business. I'm going to be Steve Jobs' best friend and Time Magazine Person of the Year, right? That's kind of the low goals that I set for myself. And I succeeded in step number one, which was selling everything without a plan and arriving in Silicon Valley. But in everything else, I failed, obviously. And so it took me, I worked on that startup for 5 years. I made all the mistakes in the world. I knew nothing about nothing, right? I really, my English was terrible. I didn't know anything about startups. I didn't know anything about technology or software. I didn't know anybody. And so I had a really hard time. Those 5 years were just pure internal turmoil, stress, anxiety.
Had you raised money and all that?
No. I had like a, so I brought I think 100 or 150K of all the savings that I've made. I've made a good bunch of money before. Yeah. I'm like 23, 24, so I arrived with some cash, and then I was very frugal. So I wasn't spending the cash on anything. I started spending it on the first kind of developer, two developers that I'd hired. And I raised money. You want to hear this? All right. So this is my entire fundraising story in like a sentence or two. For that company, I raised money for 24 months straight. And you know how much money I raised? I raised 50K.
In 2 years of...
2 years of fundraising, 50K. Well, which, not from one person, but listen, not from one person, Josh, from like four people. Oh, so it was like 8K or 10K. I mean, all the fucking mistakes you could ever make. The word, like, if you're like, who can win the Olympics of raising money, but just doing it really, really poorly? I was up there. So, yeah, it was like the bit of money that I brought with me and then the bit of money that I raised. And then all the people that worked with me on that startup were as young as me, as inexperienced, had arrived in Silicon Valley for a few months, and we're all taking very little money. I had come up with some kind of a nice way not to pay too much on rent, right? I rented this expensive place, but I subleased it to, I was friendly subleasing to people that were from Europe and only staying for 3-4 months. Yeah. I was subleasing it expensively. So my rent was effectively $400 a month. I was not going out. I was not partying. I was not purchasing anything. I had no personal life whatsoever, and I didn't spend a lot of money. And so that money lasted me for, I would say, like 3.5 years or so. And then for the last year or two, I actually had to go in debt with my friends. So I had a bunch of friends that I had helped out when I had a lot of money. And that was lucky because then when I needed it, all of them lent me money. And I basically probably took another 50K in money from kind of friends and family. That was the money that financed me for 5 years and all the employees and all the people that I hired for the company.
So you're what, about 5 years into this thing, maybe $250,000 sort of sunk into this over the years. Yeah. I mean, what, how did it all kind of come to an end?
Yeah, painfully and slowly. So this thing was dead, I think, after year two or three, but then for another two and a half years, I pretended it wasn't. Right, I just walked into rooms with a skeleton and going, no, don't panic, it's all right. All we need is some food and some water, and it's going to come alive again, and everything's going to be fine. And so I was in strong denial externally and internally, but I was deeply, deeply burned out and depressed and whatever. So I was struggling heavily internally. But eventually, so what happened was eventually I ran out of people I wanted to ask for money. Let's say that I didn't run out of people that I could ask for money for, but I didn't want to ask any more people for money. I knew this was just not going anywhere. And then I still, if you had forced me to say this company is done, I would have never been able to say these words. I would still work today on this. So I couldn't speak the words, this isn't working, because I was so attached to it. So what I did, I found a way around it for me and for everybody else that was involved. And so at some point I had a meeting, we sat down and I was like, listen, guys, you're all broke. Half of you are in debt. I'm in debt. I don't have any money anymore. We don't have any money anymore. I think a few weeks after we had the final, we came very close to raising money from a big VC and multiple times, but that was the final VC that said no in the last inning. And I was like, all right, we're all done. We're overworked and burned out. Let's take a vacation from this startup. Let's take 3 months. In those 3 months, everybody here figures out a way to make a living, to get back on their feet, take a break. I'm going to be maintaining the users that we have and the things that need to be done every day on the site, but we're not trying to grow this. We're not trying to raise any money. We're not trying to do anything else. In 3 months, we're going to put this in the calendar now. We're going to have dinner and we're going to see if we want to, what do we want to do? Do we want to start working on this again? What do we want to do? But for now, we just need to break. And everybody was relieved when I said that. We had not talked about it, but everybody was like, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. Yeah. Let's just do that. And I think within a day or two, everybody realized this isn't a vacation. We're never going to come back to this, right? But just I couldn't say it. I couldn't make that decision. So that was my cop out.
So everybody's sort of on their break / they're done. So like what was the next step for you?
Yeah, I think I started seriously considering for the first time in my life to get a real job, right? I was like, I probably just need to work for somebody to make some money. I need some money right now. Like, fuck changing and helping the world. Fuck what I'm interested in. I just need some money to pay back my debt and to get back on my feet. How can I do this? And I didn't get very far because I started like pinging a bunch of people and asking them for gigs. I started thinking about, again, you know, I can't help myself. So I started thinking about like short-term, what is a small instant business that's easy to launch that's just making money, right? So I'm like thinking about all these little things I could instantly do. And it was just around the time that Groupon had blown up and became this huge unicorn. Everybody was admiring their business model innovation, how much cash they were making. I was like, maybe I can do something Groupon-like but small and that makes instant cash. And I'm not going to even tell you what I did there. It was a pretty fantastic little startup that didn't go anywhere. But so I worked on a few small projects and I was interviewing and trying to find a gig. And then a friend of mine that I'd been friends with for 5 years pinged me and said, hey, I have this cool idea. I want your feedback. I think you'll like it. And I did like it. And I gave him some feedback and we started talking about it every day. And then very quickly, that little idea that we started talking about became a big idea. And then within just a few weeks, we had an MVP, we had launched it, we had a little bit of traction. And I had a few investors that had told me no from a prior company. And I was like, you know what, let's just go and tell them about this idea and see what they think. And we told them and all of them wanted to invest. And I was like, oh, and that's what I did next. I started my next business.
Well, so what was that business that you...
That business was called Swipegood, which is the, it's the business and the corporate entity that is closed today. So I started it with my two clothes that I owe co-founders, but it was a completely different idea when we started. Yeah. And the idea was called Swipegood. And it was simple. You could sign up with your credit or debit card. And then every time you would purchase something, we would round up that purchase to the nearest dollar and take the change and give it to your favorite charity. And if you didn't know what your favorite cause is, we had something called Smart Giving, where contextually, based on your spending, we would give to good causes. So you buy food, we give food for the poor. You buy books on Amazon, we buy something that educates children somewhere. So it was like contextually, based on your spending, you would give, allocate some amount of money to good causes. That was the initial idea.
And then you guys would take a percentage of something to...
Yeah, so the average roundup amount per person would be $20 a month in total. And we would take like 5%, which is like a dollar a user a month.
Gotcha. Okay. So how does that transition into, I mean, because there's a, did it transition to Elastic after that?
Yeah, it did. Funny enough. So this idea gained a quick traction. And then we applied for YC and we got accepted into YC with this idea. So we went through the program, and during that program, we had fantastic growth for a variety of reasons. We go on to raise, so this time around, so first time I raised 50K in like 24 months, second time around, I raised 1.3, 1.2 million in like 2 weeks, right? So we raised a bunch of money. Everything is now working much better, and I see all the success that I was struggling with not being able to obtain before. And then we started struggling again, right? So the distribution models that we used to see great early growth stopped working at a certain level of scale. We were banging our heads to find another way to keep growing this service, and we did a bunch of crazy stuff. None of that worked. And that was the time where we started thinking, okay, what are we going to do here? What's next? And we started thinking about actually focusing this on, instead of going to consumers, going to businesses and selling businesses on... you know, having all their credit cards enrolled in this and having their employees enrolled and then matching those. So making this more of a like a corporate giving thing, an effortless corporate giving thing. So we started thinking about, you know, developing a sales pitch and writing cold emails and getting meetings with large corporations, eBay and a bunch of other big companies and pitching them this. And we started talking about sales teams, right? And we're like, it's interesting. Right now, one of the biggest struggle that I see with most of our kind of batchmates and YC and other startups is none of these startups in Silicon Valley know how to hire salespeople, understand the value of sales, or know how to scale sales. So hard, but it's so valuable. And we started talking about that. And eventually we said the words, wouldn't it be awesome if something like Amazon AWS existed for sales, right? Just change servers to salespeople. So I just want to go online and say, I need 20 sales reps or 5 sales reps, spin them up right now. here's the, I upload the leads, I upload the pitch, and then I can listen to them in real time, how they make calls, how they send emails. I can track their performance. If it's going well, I add more salespeople to this. If it doesn't go well, I scale this down. Or if I want to experiment with an idea, I can quickly spin this up and down within the week and generate some results. And we got very excited about, like, actually my two engineering co-founders, my two technical co-founders got incredibly excited about this. And I instantly got really worried about this idea. I was like, wait a second, this is not that easy to do. This sounds amazing, but it's incredibly hard. And they're like, well, if it's hard, it's probably a good idea for somebody to work on this, right? It means it's really valuable. And so for a while, we were going back and forth about this idea that now all of a sudden we got more excited about than the swipe good thing for corporates, right? Which is never what we really want. We never wanted that thing to be like a corporate giving company. Yeah. And eventually we were like, you know what, let's not argue about this back and forth. Let's maybe just run an experiment for a week or two and see what kind of results we could generate. And if it doesn't work, we can just kill this discussion. And if it does, we can revisit it if we rather pursue that than the original idea. And that's what happened. We did a little test run for 2 weeks, cold calling and pitching startups on this idea. I was using a fake name. We didn't want to have any credibility, and we didn't want anybody to know that we're thinking about doing something different. And within 2 weeks of cold calling, we had 7 companies that wanted to pay us thousands of dollars to do this for them. And we're like, oh shit, maybe there's something there. And that's how we moved from, you know, end consumer product that rounds up your change for charity to outsourced Elastic Salesforce on demand. Like, those, as Paul Graham said when I told him the first time about this, I'm like, we have an idea to pivot. And he's like, this isn't a pivot. You have to have one foot in the same place to pivot. He's like, this is a jump. And it sounds like a good jump, so you should take it. We're like, oh, okay. So that's how we ended up with Elastic Sales, and then in Elastic Sales, ended up building Close.
So, and that was Close basically just sort of this like outpouring of the technology you were building for Elastic Sales, like productized?
So when we started Elastic, I think we quickly thought of the idea of like, you know what, let's build software to be the secret sauce that scales this global outsourced Salesforce. Mm-hmm. That's a cool idea. Also, we have 2 developers, 2 technical co-founders. What are they going to do all day while I'm the outsourced salesperson? Also, I'm the outsourced salesperson, which means I need to use a CRM, and I hate it with a passion, all the CRMs that were available at the time. So all these things came together and led us to the conclusion, this services business should be powered by awesome software. And we didn't know what awesome software meant. We didn't have any clear idea of that. And so by luck of building this kind of like sales lab, quote unquote, in the middle of Silicon Valley, we did sales for 200 different B2B venture-backed SaaS companies in the span of like 18 months or so. And so by doing all these very different campaigns and having all these different sales reps and having an engineering team and developer team that was in the middle of that room and was friendly with the sales reps, understood them, had empathy, had a high sales IQ, was observing them in their natural habitat, we slowly but surely started developing a real philosophy and point of view in terms of what is good sales software and what isn't good sales software. And the software that we were building internally started becoming really, really good. And eventually, I think the idea internally started growing that, you know what, maybe we're going to launch this software thing that we use internally as a separate product someday. That's how that happened.
So did the prospect of running a software company, I mean, at some point, I assume that became more interesting to you than the sort of scaling a sales team kind of thing?
Not really. If I'm honest, I was just at the point in time where the software became really good and we all started thinking maybe at some point in the future we're going to launch this software product, I was so over my head with running a large services business that the last thing I wanted to do is launch a software business right now, right? Mm-hmm. I was like, and I didn't have the mental energy to think maybe the software business is going to be a better business to run or easier, right? I was just so busy running this large services company and so over my level of competence in it that I was just like, yeah, someday this might be something, but I don't want to hear about it right now.
Did you enjoy running the services company?
There's parts that I loved and parts that I hated with a passion. Yeah. And it was not clear every day what was what at times. But I loved, you know, developing new sales experiments and generating results. I loved helping companies figure out their sales model. I learned that I was, you know, I had a lifelong sort of like interest in sales. I read a lot of books. I did a lot of selling. I built sales teams, but I never thought of myself as somebody who had something unique to say or had a unique point of view when it came to selling. And I enjoyed teaching what I knew and seeing that it had a great impact with people. So there were a lot of things that I really loved. And I loved learning all these things, right? We were talking to so many venture-backed startups, so many VCs. We had everybody's dirty laundry. We knew everybody's real numbers and the fake numbers that we're presenting to people. And we had access to people's CRMs and seeing what's going on. So I loved a lot of that, but I hated all the typical parts that you hate in a services business, right? Finding talent, hiring, onboarding it, dealing with client bullshit of them not wanting to pay you or just because the recommendation at the end is like your product is not ready to be sold to this type of customer yet, we're not going to see any success. The company is unhappy and is, you know, flagging the payment they made for you as fraudulent and just recharge all the money. And like the downtime, summer, nobody wanted to start a campaign. In December, nobody wanted to start a sales campaign. So you have all these employees, but you have not enough. Like there's all these like services issues that I hated. But there were lots of parts of it that I liked.
So what was sort of the catalyst for saying, okay, we're getting out of services and doing software?
Phil Frio, right? It was really him. So Phil was leading the product team and the engineering team. And Phil was kind of the person in the room with the highest level of clarity that we absolutely needed to launch the software as a separate product ASAP, that it was the future of the business, and every month that we didn't do this was a wasted month. So Phil was bothering me about this all the time and constantly was like, nah, Phil, no, later, let's talk about it in 2 months. And just as always in life, the person with the highest level of clarity always wins. So Phil just capped at it. And it's in a 1 week moment, honestly, I was just like, just to get rid of him more so than any strategic any high-level CEOing that was going on, I was just like, okay, all right, just take these three people. You get one business guy to do support and marketing and sales and everything else. And in three months, launch it, and then we'll see what happens. And that's all it took for us to decide to launch. And in January 2013, we launched Close as a software product. I was very little involved in that launch, to be honest with you, in many ways. I didn't choose the name. I didn't choose the logo. Like many decisions were made there. I was like, oh, that's what it's going to be. Okay, I don't care. Like I'm busy running this other thing right now. So they made all the decisions and they launched, and the first month was pretty good and second month was better than first. And I think by the third or fourth month, I started thinking, holy shit, this business very quickly is going to make a lot more money than the services business. And it has five people that are working on it.
Yeah.
And it's like consistent and compounding and all that good stuff. So I think then by month three or four, I started thinking this is the future. Like I need to start pouring all my attention into this, and this is what we should do.
What did the rest of the team think about this sort of side project becoming more successful than the main thing?
You know, I think it was a great tension within the company. I think from day one thing I didn't realize that was that there was always a tension between our massive services team and our small engineering team. Because for the services team was very inexperienced. All of these people had never worked at a startup or tech company. And to them, it looked like literally like the engineers just do whatever the fuck they want.
Right.
And when they miss a deadline, nothing happens. And we are working our butts off. Right. And then the engineers even have the audacity to be arrogant at times and make fun because I didn't explain this problem correctly enough or something like that. Right? Or be a little douchey like they can be at times. And so there was tension between the services team and the engineering team. I think when we launched the product, I don't know. I assume that a lot of people on the service side were nervous. You know, if this works, what does this mean? And ultimately, they were right, because by the time that we had decided that was the future of the business, we scaled down the company and we let a lot of people go that were salespeople on the services side because we didn't want to keep building or keep running that side of the business. Now, funny enough or good enough for us, we worked really hard to place all these guys in great positions, and all of them today are our friends. All of them, literally every single one of them became a customer within the first 12 months. And we were joking that there was the least scaling growth hack of all time, just hire a bunch of people that could be your future customers and then fire them. But in a really nice way, so they'll keep liking you. So they all became like sales managers, directors of sales, VPs of sales, and all became really good customers of ours. But there was great tension in the company from day one, and it was growing because the services team had a lot of pressure, right? And the engineering team had very little pressure. And I think that was just something that created camps within the company. It wasn't really good.
Yeah. Okay. So, you know, that was, you said this was what, 2013, 14, something like that?
Yeah. We launched in January 2013.
Okay.
And by January 2014, we had completely shut down the services company, scaled it down, and we were only running clothes.
Full-on software company.
Yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, what was like, really, I guess this was your first, like, just all-out software company, right? I mean, like, this is the first, everything else is tech. Well, okay, the education, I guess.
Yeah, the education platform was full-on software.
So this is the first, I guess, B2B.
That is the first B2B, yes.
Yeah. So what was that? I mean, really, I guess thinking back through all the previous stuff you've done, I mean, this is sort of like the first time you're like really going after businesses as your customer. I mean, what, I guess that sort of contrasting businesses as your customers versus the consumer as your customer, and like what sort of did you find more interesting about businesses as customers versus consumers with things like DVDs or education?
Yeah. So I think I realized that. So I had to go through a few iterations of self-awareness as a founder. And I think the beginning, I had this like idolized idea that I needed to build a product or create a thing that everybody on this planet knows and uses. And then I went through the Steve Jobs era of like, I need to be a product visionary, right? Mm-hmm. So during the education startup, one of the reasons why it failed, one of the many reasons why it failed, was that I was the product manager of it, and I am not a good product manager. And so I think by the time that we moved into B2B, like we were lucky that with Elastic Sales already, with Elastic Sales, we learned so much that Close's launch benefited from, right? We did all these sales campaigns and basically acquisition campaigns for all these SaaS B2B companies that by the time that we launched our own SaaS B2B company, we had a lot of lessons learned and tactics already in place. So we had a lot of unfair competitive advantages there. I think what I loved most, what I fell in love with when it comes to B2B, was that it was less of a hit-driven business. It seemed to me much more straightforward. Like it seemed harder to build something that within 6 months is a $1 billion business, right? But it seemed much easier to build a multi-million-dollar business and not to rely too heavily on luck. And it seemed, I was pretty convinced, and I still am, that it's not easy, but it's much more straightforward to build like a 100 million revenue business in B2B than a 100 million revenue business in the end consumer world. Maybe it's just because it's not my world or I'm not necessarily talented in that type of thing, but it seems much more hit driven. You have to have your pulse on the finger of the time and the people. You have to know what the masses want and you have to hit the nerve at the right time. It's much more hit driven or having that sixth sense that I was lacking. But B2B businesses were fairly simple, right? They are interested in making more money and saving money. It's fairly easy to identify them. It's fairly easy to figure out what is generating value and benefit. There are ways that they buy that are also not rocket science. And so if you follow a certain path, I felt like success was much more guaranteed. And I liked that. And then I realized that I liked having entrepreneurs as customers. I liked having startups as customers. I really loved and cared a lot more about small and medium-sized businesses and bringing value to them. It's something much closer to my heart than, you know, making every human being on the planet, you know, spend 5 minutes a day on my app on something or making young people really excited about some cool thing that I've done. It's just not my crowds, right?
Yep. So Close is a completely remote team, but like that wasn't the case, I guess, in the early days.
The beginning? No.
So what was that transition like?
Yeah. So when we started, we had a small office in Palo Alto. We were six people. Like when we downsized from Elastic, when we were like downsized from Elastic to only run Close, we had downsized to six people. Uh-huh. And and so we had an office in Palo Alto, but we were what I would call semi-remote in the sense that it was very rare that we were all there. So a lot of us traveled a lot. And so we had kind of a rhythm and a cadence where 1 month out of the quarter, we'd all be there and working out of the office. 1 month out of the quarter, people were in and out or not there at all. People were traveling. It was just like two people in the office, just one or three, but it was always somebody missing traveling and working. And once every quarter, we would all together travel to a place for 2-3 weeks and work from an Airbnb together. So we were never as attached to the office as we were before when we had this big office space with all these salespeople and this big services team. We knew we didn't really want that. And so we had this kind of loose relationship to an office. And then when we started hiring, the first few people we hired were very natural hires that were based on like, who do we already know that we like and trust that could be great for this thing that we need right now? And these people were childhood friends or friends of ours that just didn't happen to live in the Bay Area. And we didn't think about it too much. We were like, yeah, this person's awesome. We need somebody. Let's just hire that person remotely. I'm not in the office all the time anyways either. And we communicate mostly via chat and in email and in like, so we don't really need somebody in the office. And so we hired the first two people remotely that were friends of ours that we already knew and trusted. And that worked out really well for us. And then at some point we hired the first one or two people that we didn't know before. We're like, let's see how that goes. Let's see if remote works when you don't have a prior relationship. And those hires worked out pretty well for us. And eventually it was kind of like 50-50. So six people that were living in the Bay Area and sometimes working from the office, and six people that were living all around the world. And I think around that time we asked ourselves, all right, we need to be all in one way or another. Either we're going to go all remote and we need to give up on this office, because it creates a two-class society. It's like the founding team that lives in the same area and can meet together and have all these important discussions because it's the founder plus the three most senior people, and then everybody, the rest, right, yep, that lives somewhere. We're like, either we're going to stop hiring remotely and try to build a headquarter or an office-based company, or let's just go all in and be all equal in the way that we work in this company. Yeah. And that was a really good decision. That's the decision we made, I think, around the time we were 50-50. That's now, I don't know, 2-3 years ago, maybe. 3 years probably. And we never looked back.
So, you know, you guys, I mean, I'm making an assumption here, but I mean, you have a sales team, right?
Right.
So in my head, I picture sales teams as being a lot of sales, a lot of times happening in person, especially when you're talking like Silicon Valley kind of stuff, and being sort of this, having everybody in the same place, like a whole sales team in one place. There's this sort of like competitive aspect of it that's fostered by having everybody in one place. I mean, what's it been like for you building a sales team, a fully remote sales team?
Yeah. So I think there's pros and cons to all of this stuff, right? I think generically running a remote company, I love it. I wouldn't do it differently. But I know there's things that are huge benefits and there's certain things that are much harder to do. So you have to pay attention to that. The same thing is true in sales. Sales might be one of those heightened cases. You're right. I think your instinct is correct there, that the average salesperson out there is somebody that's much more externally driven to a certain degree, that will flourish in a competitive room full of other humans displaying success. So there's like that kind of the feed of energy, human energy, right? So there's a lot of human energy around them. They usually will be happier and perform better than when they are alone in some, you know, home office or something. Mm-hmm. So when you want to build a remote sales team, I mean, this has amazing benefits, right? Your talent pool now, again, is global. You can cover a lot of time zones of different areas that it would be much more expensive and harder to do if you had to open an office to hire sales reps to do that, and a bunch of other things. But do people exist out there that can be tremendously successful remote salespeople? Yes, they're just a very unique group of sales reps today, mm-hmm. And so you have to spend a lot more time finding them, and you have to spend a lot more time designing kind of what the sales team experience looks like when it's remote. So it's harder work than hiring a remote engineering team.
Right.
But it's not impossible. And there's many companies that are, I think, you know, the just like with the engine, like building a remote engineering team was something that started a number of years ago. And now today we're getting to a certain level of competence with, it doesn't seem like a crazy idea. Or it doesn't seem like a just pure, oh, you have a bunch of shitty developers that are just very cheap. That's why you're doing this, right? Yeah. It doesn't seem like that. We've outgrown that. I think the same thing is just starting in sales, where us and companies like Envision has a remote sales team. And yep. So there's a bunch of companies that have started building remote sales teams. And I think that it's still very foreign and hard to do. But, you know, in the next 5 to 10 years, I think it's going to become more and more common. And we're going to learn the best practices. More reps, more salespeople are going to be interested in the benefits of that and learn how to be successful and effective working remotely. And so we're going to get better and better at this. I think it's inevitable.
Yeah. Last sort of topic here that I'd love to talk about is so you're sort of this prolific content creator. I mean, in that you've produced tons of videos, you've got your own podcast with Heat and Shower, you've got like hundreds of episodes, you speak at lots of events. Like, how do you balance all of that with sort of the day-to-day CEO kind of stuff? Or are those sort of one and the same to you?
So what I love most about your question is that by the time you said the word prolific, you could hear your face squeezing as in like, prolific? I'm not sure. Like, that was great delivery. You're like, you're like this really prolific, I guess. I love that. So how do I, a lot of people ask me this. And my answers would vary depending on when you ask me, right? So timing matters. But in general, I have to say that, I spend a lot less time creating content than people realize. Mm. And I am very, very efficient at it because of a number of factors. One benefit that I have is that I have a lot of storytelling experience. I have a lot of experience in doing that, writing stuff, creating posts, creating videos. And eventually I got proficient at it. And I have, so everything in my life is, and you know this by now probably, once you've done content for a long enough time, everything in life, you look at it from, is this a piece of content lens?
Yep, yep.
So what happens with me is that I really, I'll give you a great example with a podcast, right? So Heaton and I started a podcast and we've been running it now for 3 years or something. We have like, we're going to cross the 400 episodes. And so this is, a shit ton of hours of content. Heaton and I spend exactly 60 minutes every week on this podcast. Not a minute more, not a minute less. And here's exactly how we allocate these 60 minutes. On Friday at 9 a.m. Eastern, I call him. He picks up. I make some dumb joke. He laughs. And then I go, this is the first topic. And he goes, let's go. And then so all he knows is the word or the topic, like a sentence. I want to talk about whatever, landing pages. Cool, let's go. And so we record for 10 minutes. We end the recording and then I go, next topic, Heaton, is this. Founder depression. He's like, whoa, okay, let's go. And we record. And we'll record 3 to 4 episodes. And then usually I'll make another dumb joke. He'll laugh. We'll proclaim our love for each other and we hang up. These 3 to 4 recordings go into a Dropbox folder to never be seen again by me, right? And that's it. And then I forget about the whole thing. Thursday night, I have a reminder to look at the spreadsheet of topics, and then I'll come up with a few topics, or usually throughout the week, maybe something stands out. I'm like, oh, that's going to be a topic for Friday, and I'll put it in the spreadsheet. So I'll look at it. So I'm like, oh, I'm prepared for tomorrow morning. So we spent very little time on the podcast. There are many friends that I have that do a podcast that especially when it's two co-hosts, that will spend 2 to 3 hours of prep time to record an episode and another hour or so afterwards to do the summary write-up, do whatever, the editing or whatever else they're doing. So they'll spend eight hours to record a podcast when we spent 15 minutes to record one episode of the podcast.
Gotcha.
And the reason why we're able to do this is because Heaton creates a ton of content, I create a ton of content. Heaton is very experienced entrepreneur and storyteller and has so much wisdom and knows so many things. I know a little bit of things. And then we have great chemistry. And so we just instinctively, we're today able, sometimes better, sometimes worse. And I'll tell you honestly, when we started, the first year was easy. Josh, it was easy. It was beautiful because every topic was new. We had never talked about this before. Right. We had barely known each other when we started the podcast, right? So it was like we were in love and everything was cool and sexy and surprising. Everything I was saying, everything he was saying was like, wow. Today, we're an old couple, right? And so finding new things to talk about is hard. And then being surprised or delighted by the thing you learn from the other person in the conversation on ad hoc, it's harder and harder. We know each other now really, really well, right? So this has become much more hard work in terms of just being committed to the podcast. And sometimes we do episodes that are still great, and sometimes I think this was a little lukewarm. But we're definitely able to do it really, really efficiently because we've, you know, we have a system where everything that happens prior and after the podcast has been taken care of by somebody else. And we are very, very experienced and we're very efficient in churning out these episodes in a way that's still valuable to people, hopefully.
Gotcha. Yeah, that makes sense. Okay. So what's like the next year sort of look like for you and close?
Change, a lot of change, Josh. So I think the last two, I'll summarize this. This could be a whole other episode, but last 2 years there were just a bunch of things that needed to change for us to grow into the next phase of the business. That I think for a variety of reasons, mainly because change means I have to change, my co-founders have to change, the people in the company have to change. And we're all uncomfortable with change. For a variety of reasons, I think we've been kicking down the road or we've been attacking, but very timidly and very slowly. And last quarter of last year was really a pivotal moment where a bunch of aha moments happened. And I think we switched into a whole other gear. So this year is going to be, I think, a very challenging year because we're going to change a bunch of things. I can't really speak about any of them, I think, right now. But we are changing the product in a significant way. We're changing the brand in a significant way. We're changing pricing in a significant way. We're doing, organizationally, we've changed things quite significantly. So there's this year, to me, the biggest word, if I had one word, it's change. And if I had another word, it's not going to be easy. It's going to be rocky. But I'm actually excited. It feels like this was long overdue. And I'm like, I'm now excited that we're through this like resistance phase of it. And we're now at this like, all in, let's go phase of it. But I think it's going to be a challenging year and a really, really busy year with lots of changes and who knows what's going to happen.
Cool. Well, how can people follow along with that change or get in touch?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think, one way for people that appreciate podcasts and maybe like this one is to check out the Startup Chat because the topics that I propose to Heaton mostly are, you know, usually related. And if you hear a topic about changing a brand or changing pricing or anything of that sort, you can pretty much bank the fact that I'm thinking about this internally with my company. So the startupchat.com is a place to check out the podcast. You can follow me on Twitter @Stelly. But probably the best way to follow me is just to go to our blog and subscribe to it, blog.close.io. I publish a lot of videos, a lot of learnings, a lot of stuff. So if you want to follow along the way, that is probably the best place to go.
Perfect. All right. Well, that feels like a good stopping point. I thanks again for hopping on the call, man. It was good catching up.
Thank you so much for having me.
And there we have it, Stelly Efti of Close.io. Thanks for listening this week. If you need revenue analytics and insights, check out barometrics.com. If you have any feedback, I would love to hear it. Shoot me an email, josh@barometrics.com or on Twitter @Schwigford. Head to founderchats.com to listen to dozens of other conversations with startup founders. And if you enjoyed this, a rating on iTunes or sharing this with your friends goes a long way. Thanks again, and see you next week.